lives. Everybody breaks. It's just a matter of finding out how hard you have to push. Kitty spoke with a soft assurance that whispered of experiences I'd never had and never wanted to have. I found myself wondering which end of the knife she'd been on. I realized just as quickly that I really didn't want to know. That sort of thing was Verity's territory, and she was welcome to it. Kitty listened to the silence for a few seconds. Then she sighed. "Look, Sarah, if they took her prisoner, that sucks for us, because we don't know what she's going to tell them. We have to be prepared for the worst. But it could be awesome for her."
"How is being taken prisoner by the Covenant awesome for anybody?" I asked.
"People usually keep their prisoners alive for at least a little while before they kill them. If she's been taken prisoner, there's a chance that you can get her back."
"But how am I supposed to—"
"I'm sorry, Sarah. I really am. I know she's your cousin, and I know you love her. I owe her a lot. I wish it hadn't gone down like this. But you're the one who has to worry about getting her back. I'm the one who gets to worry about getting my people through this alive. Good luck."
Kitty hung up after that. She didn't say goodbye. There wouldn't have been any point. Mike and Eustace were in the main room when I emerged. The Madura I could detect was still in the kitchen. I assumed the older Madura was there with him. Having someone in the building that I couldn't hear made me profoundly uncomfortable. I was used to people being hard or even impossible to read. Them being invisible was something entirely different. It was like when... I stopped where I was, eyes going wide. Uncle Mike looked away from the deadfall he'd been arranging over one of the windows. Eustace was holding the rope that supported the deadfall's weight with one hand, like it was negligible to her, and frowned at me.
"Sarah?" he asked. "What did Kitty say?"
"That charm." I started briskly toward the table where Verity had dumped Margaret Healy's possessions. Midway there, I broke into a run. When I reached it, I started rummaging frantically through the knives, ammo packs, and things I didn't know the uses of. "Where is it? Why can't I find it?"
"Hey, hey, what are you trying to find?"
Uncle Mike's hand settled on my shoulder. His thumb grazed the skin above my collarbone. As always, the skin-to-skin contact did what it would normally take months of close contact to do. His mind snapped into sharp relief, a picture seen through a window blind that I could open if I needed to. Touching people does that for me, especially when it happens repeatedly in a short period of time. It's why I try to avoid it whenever I can, when I'm not dealing with people I'm already attuned to. Uncle Mike was petrified. He knew Verity was dead. Not because he had some fact that I was missing, just because he'd been in situations like this one before. And he knew the odds had been against us from the start.
"Should never have let her go out alone, no matter what she was used to," he was thinking.
Blame and self-loathing dripping off every thought-slash-word and sense-slash-impression.
"This is my fault. How am I going to tell Kevin that I let his baby girl go out and get herself killed? Hell, how am I going to tell Evelyn? She'll never be able to look me in the eye again. This is all..."
I shrugged his hand off, breaking the endless loop of his thoughts before it could drag me even further down. If he wanted to put on a brave face and pretend that he thought everything was going to be okay, I'd let him. As long as I made sure not to touch him again, it might even make me feel better. "The charm. The one the Covenant uses to block telepathy." I looked up at him. Margaret was a whole when we met her. She wasn't a human. She wasn't an individual. She was a whole. When Verity put the thing on to test it, she was a whole too. She vanished completely from any sort of non-visual spectrum. Uncle Mike nodded slowly.
"So you're thinking that if she's wearing one of those things, that might explain her disappearing the way she did?"
"I've never been attuned to someone who died, but I can't imagine it's as easy as, 'Ow, that hurts, oh, I'm gone.'" I stood up a little straighter, trying to ignore the waves of curiosity emanating from Eustace. At least she hadn't come over. That probably had something to do with the rope she was still holding, and the desire not to drop Uncle Mike's deadfall on the slaughterhouse floor.
She's not dead. She's just missing.
So can you track holes?
No. I can follow dead spots, maybe, if I see people with my eyes who don't appear to my mind, but... I shrugged helplessly. There are two Madura in the building. I only know that because I've seen them both. If the one I can't read decides to leave, I won't know about it. He'll just be gone, and I'll have no idea.
Your ability to observe the minds of others seems exceedingly limited in scope, commented Eastis.
She switched the rope to her other hand.
Of what use are you?
I'm really, really good at calculating how much I need to leave for a tip when I eat out, even if I never pay for my actual meals, I said flatly.
So what you're saying is that you won't know you found someone you can't read until you see them with your eyes, said Uncle Mike. Okay, that's not as convenient as it could be, but it's something. You saw Margaret, right?
She forced her way into my hotel room.
Could you describe her well enough for the mice to draw her?
I bit the inside of my cheek to keep myself from saying something I'd regret later. Then, carefully, I said, "My eyes don't work that way. Or, well, I guess they do since I see on a human wavelength, but that's not how I process visual information. There's no way I could describe her. Cuckoos can see. We're not blind, and I'm glad, since that would make answering my email really hard. But our brains aren't wired to register the same things that human brains are. We don't need to recognize individuals by their faces when we can recognize them by their thoughts, the unique mixture of ideas and emotions that make them who they are. All those shows about mistaken identity and identical twins or cousins are lost on me, because to my eyes, pretty much everyone looks cosmetically alike, and it's totally impossible to mistake anyone for anyone else. Oh, hair and eye and skin colors differ, but faces? They're just faces. It's what's behind them that's unique. Uncle Mike nodded again.
If that won't work, we'll have to think of something else. What did Kitty have to say?
She's afraid the people who have Verity will torture her and get her to reveal secrets regarding our plans and whereabouts, said Eastis, sounding bored.
Mike and I both turned to face her. She shrugged.
It is a logical concern. The current situation presents great potential for mayhem, and very little for a peaceful resolution.
This said, she yawned broadly, displaying teeth that were twice the size of the human norm. The laconic waves of thought drifting off her were almost entirely focused on the idea of destroying things.
"I'm not going to just sit around waiting for Verity to die," I said hotly. "I don't care if she's being tortured. If she's alive, we have to find her."
"We have a duty to the cryptids of the city," said Mike.
I scowled at him.
"I am a cryptid of the city, remember? And I have a duty to my family. We can't call them and tell them that she's been..."
I paused. Duty. Family.
"Wait a second. I think I have an idea."
"What?"
"The dragons. Females are basically indistinguishable from human women. We know Dominic didn't tell the Covenant about the dragons. If he had, they'd have come long before this, and they'd definitely have sent more than 3 operatives. So that means the Covenant won't be treating every blonde woman they see as a potential threat."
"So you want to what? Use the dragons as spies?" "Sarah, they're not going to go for that. Dragons are only interested in personal gain."
"That was before they had a male, and before they owed Verity for making sure they were there when he woke up." I smiled thinly. "They're going to pay what they owe, and they're going to pay it now."
"Oh, good," said Eastis, letting go of the rope. "This will almost certainly afford opportunity for carnage."
The deadfall made a horrible crunching noise when it hit the floor.
Chapter 17.
There were advantages to growing up with a cold-blooded telepath for a mother. The ability to lie about why I was out past curfew, was not among them. Evelyn Baker. The sewers below Manhattan, heading for the lair of the only known male dragon left in the world. After some perfunctory arguing, Uncle Mike knew I wouldn't listen. I knew he wasn't really trying to convince me to stay. We both knew he had to make the effort if he was going to live with himself. I was allowed to grab a city spelunking kit from Verity's supplies and head for the nearest concealed manhole. I left the weapons behind, taking only a flashlight, some rope, and a backpack full of assorted, individually wrapped snacks. There's almost nothing that lives in a sewer that will attack a cuckoo who looks like she's just passing through. There's defense of your territory, and then there's being suicidal. Besides, who needed weapons when I had Estus? She was shorter than me in her human form, and she'd never met a pair of practical shoes in her life. But she could take on just about anything that I couldn't mentally shield us from. We were an unstoppable team, or would have been, if I'd had the first clue how to talk to her. Verity always made it look so easy, while I found communication with most other cryptids really, really hard. Even when I could read their minds, I couldn't always understand what I found there. With Estus's help, I was able to get the manhole levered out of the way, by which I mean Estus picked up the manhole and tossed it off to one side, because she is not the most subtle brick in the wall, and descended the ladder to sewer level. Estus skipped the ladder in favor of simply stepping off the ledge, landing next to me without even bending her knees. Even Verity would have crouched to absorb the impact. Estus just dropped. "Come on," I said, and pulled the flashlight from my belt. She followed amiably after me as we started walking into the dark. The Wahila minced through the sludge covering the sewer floor like she was strolling down Broadway on a summer afternoon. She had added a parasol and a miniature top hat to her ensemble before we left the nest. The hat was perched jauntily just above her side-swept ponytail. From the feelings of contentment emanating from her mind, she was convinced she looked absolutely fabulous, and also anticipating the opportunity to show her fabulousness to anything that might decide to take a shot at eating us. "I don't think there are any alligators down here, you know," I said, playing the beam from the flashlight over the sewer wall. A rat ran by on urgent rat business. Estus watched it go, emotional weather briefly shifting to hungry, before swinging back to her usual calm contentment.
"No, there are not," she agreed. "There used to be, before the bugbears, servitors, and other carnivores removed them. There is, however, always the potential for a pleasant surprise. There have been rumors which indicate that a sewer kraken may be making its home downtown. I would enjoy the opportunity to battle something with that many limbs."
Given the way Estus was dressed, the idea of her fighting a sewer kraken was disturbingly like something from the kind of anime Artie liked to pretend he never watched, and I liked to pretend I didn't know about. I gave her a sidelong glance.
Estus, it was nice of you to insist on coming with me and everything, but you do know what we're doing down here, right?"
"I am not stupid, Sarah Zellaby," she said, in a voice that was much quieter than the one she'd been using only a moment before. "I realize I wear frilly clothing and impractical shoes, and that by many people's standards I am odd, but I am not stupid. You are here because you want to ask the dragons to assist in recovering your cousin. I am here because Verity is my friend, and would look on me with sadness if I were to allow you to come to harm. Friendship is a rare thing among my people. We do not practice it often, and most of us do not practice it very well. I am hoping to be a better friend to Verity than my brothers and sisters were to me."
"Oh." I kept walking. Beside me, Estus did the same, spinning her parasol lazily with each step. Finally, I said, "I forget sometimes that I can't treat you like you're human. I mean, I don't forget exactly, but..."
"Your mannerisms and reactions are human enough, despite the fact that you are biologically even less human than I am, that you sometimes forget not all hominids will follow the same behavioral patterns.
Eastis shook her head. It is a common, if unfortunate, trap of the mind. I am sorry you have fallen prey to it. I will not take offense at your ignorance.
The worst part was that she meant it. For Eastis, the matter was already forgotten. I had made the mistake of treating her like a human being. She had corrected me, and as long as I didn't do it again, there was nothing left to discuss. Being a Wahila had to be pretty simple compared to being a cuckoo. Then again, being a real cuckoo, an amoral sociopath who existed only for the sake of making other people miserable, is probably pretty easy. It's being a cuckoo like me that's hard. Sometimes I feel like neither nature nor nurture did me any favors.
Here, Sarah, have a moral and ethical code that means you'll feel bad killing people for your enjoyment, and have a set of instincts and hereditary skills that means you're not really built to do anything else. It'll be fun.
It's not fun. The sewer floor got gradually cleaner as we walked, until the sludge was gone, and the walls showed subtle signs of having been washed recently. Dragons don't like wallowing in filth any more than the rest of us. They just lived in the sewers because William had been asleep during the construction of Manhattan, and now a good-sized chunk of downtown was built over his head. Until someone figured out a way to get him out of his cavern without destroying the city, he was stuck. Not that he was complaining. Fresh air is nice, but not being slaughtered by the Covenant of St. George is nicer, and as long as he stayed underground, he was safe from most forms of detection. Most, not all. If the Covenant had Verity, and if they were able to break her, the dragons wouldn't be able to move William. We weren't ready for this. We never thought we'd need to be. Eastis looked around as we moved into the final branch of the sewer. This one looked absolutely filthy, and smelled filthy, too, until we were about 10 feet from the entrance. Then the smell of sewer was replaced by the smell of bleach and cheap air freshener. "The dragons have a good working relationship with the hide-behinds," I said. "It's a camouflage measure."
"Clever," allowed Eastis. "I have not been here since the snake cult attempted to sacrifice me to wake their sleeping dragon. I have never met William while awake."
That explained the little hat. She was trying to make a good impression.
"He's nice," I said. "He even beats me at chess sometimes." We kept walking, and the darkness around us abruptly went away, replaced by a pleasant level of soft illumination. Eastis jumped, whirling so that her back was pressed against my shoulder. I kept walking.
More hide-behind tricks. They use darks for that part of the passage, so that curious sanitation employees don't wander down here. I personally doubt that anyone would be curious enough about a dark, smelly tunnel that isn't part of the currently in-use sewer system to wander down it, but Verity swears I should never underestimate human curiosity. Humans are weird.
"I do not like this," proclaimed Eastis.
"That's part of the point." The tunnel ended at a bare wall 8 feet, 5 inches across. I knocked lightly at a point exactly at 4 feet, 2.5 inches from either wall, stepped back, and motioned for Eastis to wait. A few minutes passed. Then a door, a simple, normal wooden door, swung open in what had appeared to be solid stone, and a blonde woman in a baggy New York Giants sweatshirt peered out through the opening. I smiled pleasantly, reaching out with my mind just far enough to tap the surface of her thoughts and confirm her identity.
"Hi, Priscilla," I said. "Is Candy here? I need to talk to her."
Priscilla's ever-present frown deepened as she looked past me to Eastis, who was doing her best to look through the open door into the nest beyond.
"Why did you bring the Wahila?" she demanded.
"Because Verity was unavailable, and it's not safe for anyone to go out alone right now." Most of the female dragons picked up shifts at the freak show every now and then, and several of them worked there full time. There was no way Priscilla didn't recognize Eastis. She was just being prickly, which was something the dragons specialized in.
"Now please, can we come in before we attract attention standing here?"
Frowning even more, Priscilla said,
"Fine," and opened the door the rest of the way, beckoning us inside. "Thank you," I said, and led Eustace into the nest. Some clichés exist for a reason. Dragons and gold, for example. They love it. It's biologically and psychologically vital to their well-being, and consequentially, they collect the stuff the way Artie collects comic books. Since male dragons are larger than greyhound buses when fully grown, they serve as guardians of the hoard, while the females find ways to go out and get more gold. That used to involve highway robbery, infiltrating kingdoms, and occasionally mining. There are a lot of female dragons living in California, thanks to the gold rush. These days, about half the cash for gold franchises out there are operated by dragons, while the rest work tirelessly at whatever jobs they can get, immediately turning around and converting their paychecks into more gold for the nest. As for what they did with all that gold... We walked through the door into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, as reinterpreted by King Midas and Salvador Dali. Cardboard structures scavenged from closing Halloween specialty stores were studded around the room, all covered in a thick layer of genuine, structurally reinforcing 24-carat gold. It made a weird maze of haunted houses without backs, abandoned tunnels, and crooked graveyard fences. William enjoyed metalworking, and he was on his own forge, so he just let the girls bring home whatever they thought would go well in the nest. If it didn't work out, he could always remelt the gold and try again. More normal furniture from thrift shops and IKEA was scattered around the gold sculptural pieces, along with the better part of a playground. There was a slide, a jungle gym, even a swing set, and all of it was plated with still more gold. Gold bars, coins, chains, even gold leaf littered the floor of the cavern, making our footing a little unsteady. We were standing in the midst of several hundred years of concentrated penny pitching, and oh, how it glittered. Eustace looked around without shame, lazily twirling her parasol. Finally she said,
"It is very sparkly."
"It is at that," I said, just before a swarm of young dragon girls, none of them older than 8, came running from the direction of the jungle gym, waving their arms in the air and shouting my name. I didn't recognize any of them, and when they came at me in a pack like that, I couldn't pick out individual minds. That didn't particularly matter. I stooped and swept up the first one to reach me, swinging her up in the air and draping her over my shoulder like a potato sack. This put her nose to nose with Eustace, who surveyed our sudden ocean of giggling preteens with bemusement.
"Hi," said the dragon on my shoulder. "I'm Eva. I'm a dragon. Who are you?"
"I am Eustace," Eustace replied gravely. "I am not a dragon."
"I knew that," said Eva. "But you're not a cuckoo either, 'cause you have the wrong eyes. And you're not a human, because Aunt Priscilla wouldn't have let you in without calling for Aunt Candy. What are you?"
"Eustace is a Wahila," I said, and put Eva down. "Go find your Aunt Candy for me, okay?"
"Okay,"
said Eva, and the swarm moved on, running easily over the uneven floor. A few of them ran backward so that they could wave. I waved back and tried not to look relieved. Sometimes the little girls would spend an hour or more making me do parlor tricks before they got bored. And when you've read one preteen dragon's mind, you've read them all. I resumed walking. Eustace did the same, looking at me while confusion wafted off her thoughts like smoke.
"If you have sent them to retrieve Candy, why are we not waiting?"
"Because I have a landmark to say hello to." I gestured toward the far wall of the cavern, where one of the only things that was neither blonde nor covered in gold was waiting for us. William raised his head as we approached, opening enormous eyes the color of electric jack-o'-lanterns. His lips turned upward in an eerily human smile, considering that he was a giant fire-breathing semi-saurian cryptid.
"Sarah,"
he said, his crisp British accent somehow making things all the more incongruous. Even dragons have to come from somewhere. William came from England, back when the United States of America were still the 13 original colonies,
in a very real way. This country was built on top of him.
"Hey, Billy," I said, waving. "You remember Eastis? She was here when you woke up."
"But she was unconscious at the time, as I recall."
William lowered his head, putting Eastis at eye level. That wasn't necessarily a comfortable place to be. His head, after all, was the size of a VW bus.
"A pleasure to properly make your acquaintance, Miss Eastis. I truly do appreciate your efforts on my behalf."
Undaunted, Eastis looked him in the eye. Then, solemnly, she curtsied. "It is very nice to meet you." I will never understand people, no matter how long I live. And that could be a very long time if the Covenant of St. George doesn't kill me. Cuckoos have an extremely high life expectancy.
"We're here to talk to you, and to Candy," I said.
"It's about Verity." William's smile faded, replaced by an expression of profound concern.
"Oh, dear. Has Miss Verity's unsuitable swain finally turned against her?"
"Not that I'm aware of, thankfully, but that's sort of the problem."
I could hear Candy's thoughts clearly enough to know that she was pissed about us being here. Also that she was coming up behind me. I turned.
"Hi, Candy."
The current nest mother stopped and folded her arms over her chest, glaring so hard that even I could recognize it. Candy hated the fact that I could always recognize her, since she knew I didn't do faces. What she never quite understood was that I do minds instead, and hers was distinctive.
"What are you doing here?" she demanded, turning her glare from me to Eastis, who looked impassively back.
"What if you were followed?"
"We weren't followed," I said.
"What if you were?"
"I would have ripped and torn and broken the bodies of our pursuers, and it would have been glorious," said Eastis.
She sounded so calm that we all turned to look at her, even William. Heedless, Eastis gave her parasol a spin and added,
"I would have brought you their heads. I think it would have made a suitable subterranean cavern warming present."
The silence that followed this announcement lasted for several seconds. I was the one to break it, turning to Candy and saying,
"We're here because we need your help."
"Did Verity send you because she knew I'd tell her no?" asked Candy.
"She already has our slaughterhouse. She doesn't need any more help from us."
"Verity didn't send me," I said.
"Verity's gone."
Candy paused. William snorted out a small puff of smoke.
"Gone?" he asked.
"Gone. Something knocked her out about an hour ago. It hurt like hell, and I haven't been able to reach her since."
Candy's thoughts turned alarmed.
"Oh, God. What if she's not dead?"
"Candice," said William chidingly. "That isn't a nice thing to say in front of her family."
"But it's true. What if she's not dead? What if the Covenant has her? She knows where we are. We can't move you."
Candy put her hands protectively over her belly, starting to cry. That was an expression even I could read without second-guessing myself.
"We can't lose you. I can't leave you."
"I don't think she's dead, but I don't think she's told them anything either," I said. Seeing Candy cry made it oddly a little easier to stay calm. It was like she was freaking out on my behalf. "They haven't had her long enough, and I don't think there's any torture they could subject her to that would make her give you up in less than a day. If they have a telepath, they're using anti-telepathy charms. If they had a telepath, they'd have to remove those charms from Verity in order to get any kind of information out of her, and I'd know where she was. Since she hasn't been appearing and disappearing from my radar, they aren't removing the charms, and they don't have a telepath. Human methods of getting information aren't good, but they're not going to break Verity Price in less than a day. We have time to find her, if we start moving now."
"We can't," Candy began.
"Anything you need," said William.
She stopped, turning to look at him. Her eyes were wide, and her confusion was a raw wound on her emotional landscape. He blew a puff of flame in her face, sending it dancing along her hair.
It wasn't the aggressive gesture it would have been with anything but another dragon. Candy was fireproof. For her, that was an affectionate peck on the cheek.
"I would not be with you now if not for Verity. We owe it to her family to do what we can to bring her home. Moreover, you're correct. She knows where I am. If the Covenant has her, she has to be taken from them, or you'll lose me again."
He ducked his head enough to nudge her belly, ever so gently, with the tip of his snout.
"I want to meet our baby. I want to see how many of you are carrying fine, strong sons to bring joy to the other golden ones, waiting lonely around this world. How can we deny these women the aid they need?"
Candy sniffled. Then she sighed, turning back to me, and asked, "What is it you want from us?" Candy listened attentively as I explained my plan. She even suggested a few things I hadn't considered, like using the kids, in a swarm and with the help of some of the adults, to canvas parks and playgrounds, since they'd be able to ask really blatant questions without anyone thinking it was strange. Little girls can get away with a lot just by looking cute and clueless when they're doing it. When we were done talking, William and Candy had promised to dispatch every available female dragon, omitting the pregnant ones, the ones assigned to tend the eggs that had already been laid, the ones under 5 years of age, and the babysitters, to start searching the city for my missing cousin. They'd phone the nest if they found anything, and then Candy, who was staying put because of her pregnancy, would call me. If they actually found Verity, as opposed to just finding information that might lead us to her, they'd bring her back to the old nest. "Thank you," I said, for the eighth time, as Candy walked us to the door. "Thank my husband," she said. "I understand why he wants us to help you, but if we didn't have to stay here and protect him, we'd be gone." "I know."
"You have a lovely home," said Eustace amiably.
That seemed like a good place to end things. We walked out the door, which closed behind us, blending seamlessly back into the stone wall. Eustace spun her parasol.
"I think that went quite well, despite the lack of carnage," she said.
"I hope so." I started walking. "There are a lot of dragons. They can cover a lot of ground. I just hope none of them get hurt."
"If they do, we will avenge them," said Eustace.
Once again, that seemed like a good place to end things. I didn't say anything for the rest of our trip back through the sewer to the manhole where we'd made our descent. It was still uncovered, probably because Eustace had thrown the lid too far away for anyone with normal human strength to drag it back into position. I made a note to ask her to put it back where it belonged, just as soon as we were above ground, and started up the ladder. I was almost to the top, when a figure loomed above the opening, and a hand was thrust down into the darkness, grabbing my forearm. I squeaked, and was about to scream, when the static kicked on, and I realized who had hold of me. Fighting wasn't going to help. I let myself be pulled the rest of the way up into the light. Dominic released me as soon as I was on solid ground. We both stepped back to let Eustace out of the hole. She looked at Dominic, sniffed the air, and frowned.
"You are unwell," she informed him. "I will end you if you have harmed Verity."
"I know," said Dominic quietly.
Even I could tell that he wasn't looking good. His hair was uncombed, and there were dark circles around his eyes. He looked like a man who'd just realized he was in the middle of fighting a war. "Dominic?" I said. He turned to me.
"Sarah."
He sounded relieved.
"I need your help."
"Is Verity alive?" I didn't know what I was going to ask until the question was out, and then there was nothing else I could have asked him. Nothing else in the world.
"Yes."
He nodded.
"But I don't know how long she will be. We need to move."
"You know I can't trust you."
"Yes, you can."
He held out his arm in silent invitation. I didn't say anything. Dominic knew what he was offering me, and how much stronger I would be if I were touching him. Before either of us could change our minds, I reached out and grabbed his wrist. Diving into his psyche as hard and deep as I could without pausing to make the process easy on either one of us. This wasn't the time to be gentle. Dominic gritted his teeth, and he didn't pull away. Telepathy, cuckoo telepathy anyway, is usually a passive thing, polite and non-invasive. Sure, I may learn a person's deepest, darkest secrets, but it doesn't hurt them, and it doesn't hurt me. This wasn't like that. This was a home invasion of the soul, and it made me feel dirty even as I was doing it. Dominic's mind was filled with cluttered rooms packed with thoughts and memories even he wasn't fully aware of anymore. He didn't think he remembered what his mother looked like. He did. He just had the memory walled off by so many other things that it only came to the surface when he slept, or, oddly, when he ate German chocolate. He was in love with Verity. He hated the smell of violets in the rain. That was connected to his mother's death, and was part of the wall between him and the memory of her face. He wasn't a part of the plan that captured Verity. The rest of the Covenant agents in town hadn't even told him they suspected she existed. He thought they suspected him of being a traitor. He didn't care. After we got Verity back, he was done with the Covenant of St. George. Dominic DeLuca was finally picking a side. And it wasn't theirs. I let go of his wrist, breaking the telepathic contact at the same time. He gasped, and I realized just how pale he'd gotten. "Sorry," I said mentally. "I know that can be rough."
"It's all right," he said.
Then he paused.
"You didn't speak."
I smiled a little. I didn't have to. After that kind of excavation, we're attuned. Welcome to the family. Now let's go and get my cousin back from your ex-allies.
Chapter 18. The trouble with the Covenant of St. George is that it encourages loyalty through ignorance, zealotry, and fear. I wonder sometimes, what would they have accomplished if they'd tried doing it all with love? Enid Healy. A converted slaughterhouse in the meatpacking district. Eastis walked into the warehouse ahead of us, her parasol resting against her shoulder. She looked utterly relaxed, which may be the only reason no one attacked Dominic on sight. They were too busy staring at the muck-encrusted Wahila. "Dominic is not responsible for Verity's disappearance, and is no longer affiliated with the Covenant of St. George," she announced. "The telepathic girl without a proper circulatory system says so, and as she has no reason to lie, I am choosing to believe the story which presents the highest odds of future carnage."
"That's my girl," said Ryan,
but his voice was several octaves lower than normal, and he seemed taller as he got up from his seat. Uncle Mike didn't bother standing. He just produced a gun from somewhere inside his jacket and raised it to shoulder level, the muzzle trained on Dominic's throat.
"I admire the efficiency, but can you at least try not to get arterial spray in my hair?" I asked.
"Hello, sir," said Dominic. "I assume you're Verity's father. I wish we were meeting under better circumstances."
Uncle Mike blinked, looking nonplussed.
"Excuse me?"
"Dominic, this is our uncle, Mike Gucciard." Telling him Uncle Mike's last name was a warning that the choice Dominic was making was irrevocable. If Dominic so much as twitched in the direction of the Covenant after this, he'd find himself stuffed into a dumpster somewhere in Midtown. There are things we don't screw around with, and that includes the covers of our friends and allies.
"Uncle Mike, this is Verity's boyfriend, Dominic DeLuca. He's here to tell us how to get her back, and to discuss the many fabulous advantages to defecting to the side with the sense of humor."
"The sense of humor, and the many, many unmarked body disposal sites," said Uncle Mike.
I'd never heard his voice that devoid of warmth.
"Please go easy on him," I said quietly. "He's our best shot at finding Verity."
"Or he's lying to you," Uncle Mike shot back. "Did you consider that?"
I sighed heavily. "Okay, so, is it time to have the talk about lying to the telepath again? I say, don't lie to the telepath, it never works, and you all say you won't. And then I point out that the corollary to this is when the telepath says someone isn't lying, she's probably right. That's when you look sheepish and say you're sorry and, hey, look, I just shortcut about 10 minutes of awkward conversation. Go me. Now, can we get on with saving Verity from the Covenant, or do I have to get annoyed?"
There was a moment of silence before Eustace said, "I was unaware the telepathic girl possessed a temper. This is pleasing. Temperamental people are more likely to participate in carnage."
"Sweetie, what have we talked about?" asked Ryan.
Now it was Eustace's turn to sigh. "Humans are discomforted by excessive discussion of their squishy interiors, which means no referencing carnage more than once in a single conversation. As the dominant human in the room, that rule is hereby suspended until we get my niece back," announced Uncle Mike.
Now he stood, stalking toward Dominic with the calm, predatory assurance of a man who knew damn well that he was armed to the teeth and ready to kill anything standing in his way. I knew I wasn't in danger. I still took a step away from Dominic, just in case. Uncle Mike kept walking until the two of them were almost nose to nose, lowering his gun at the last minute as he looked the younger man square in the eye. To Dominic's credit, he stood his ground. Then again, maybe that was a sign that he was too stupid to live.
"Sarah's vouching for you, and that would normally be enough for me. But my niece's life is on the line," said Uncle Mike.
His tone was absolutely level. That was another warning sign, and I took another step away from them.
"If you're lying to us, if I find out you're using some Covenant trick to lie to us, I won't just kill you. I'll hurt you. I'll make you sorry that you ever came to America, and then I'll make you even sorrier to have tangled with my family. Do I make myself clear?"
"Yes, sir," said Dominic.
"And if I may be blunt, sir, I'm already sorry to have encountered your family."
Uncle Mike's eyebrows shot up. Then they lowered again, coming together as he scowled.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"Before I met your niece, I was content to be ignorant of the true nature of this war and my place in it. Without her influence, I might have been able to spend my entire life believing monster was the word for cryptid and traitor was the word for Price. I would have been unaware of how incomplete my understanding was. I would have continued to think that I was happy."
Dominic gave a small shake of his head.
"I want to find Verity more than anything else.
I want to bring her home and never let her go. I want to learn everything there is to know about this maddened mirror image of the world where I grew up. But here and now, I am frightened, and she is missing, and part of me is sorry I ever got involved."
"He's telling the truth," I said. "In case anyone cares." Once again, every head turned toward me. Uncle Mike radiated disapproval.
"I didn't expect you to take his side, Sarah. Do I need to remind you of what his kind does to yours?"
"Uncle Mike, I love you, and I know what you're trying to say. But I'm a cuckoo. Killing cuckoos isn't a sign of evil. It's a sign of sanity. Killing other sapient cryptids is another matter, and that's something I've never seen Dominic do. Plus, he's in love with Verity. That sort of puts him in my good graces."
"I am in love with her, and would prefer she remain among the living," said Dominic. "Please. I don't know what I can possibly do to prove myself to you, and I doubt that we have time for anything that you might name. Verity is alive, but that doesn't mean she's not in danger. Time is short. I need your help." "Goddamn kids,"
muttered Uncle Mike. Then he stepped away from Dominic, moving out of the other man's personal space.
Okay, Covenant boy. Tell us what you know.
Margaret Healy loves her duty and hates your branch of the family in equal measure, said Dominic, apparently counting both myself and Uncle Mike as official members of the Price Healy clan for purposes of this debriefing. It made sense. Even if we weren't related by blood, we were tainted by the ideology that led her actual relatives astray. I was honestly surprised to see her with the review team. The last time we spoke, she was still barred from activities in North America.
Why?
Asked Ryan. Margaret never believed that the Michigan incident had truly eliminated all survivors of the family on this continent. She wanted to investigate in person. Our superiors felt this was a personal vendetta with no immediate benefit to the Covenant.
You mean they were worried she might be right and that she might set off a war, said Uncle Mike.
Dominic nodded. I think that was a factor in their decision, yes. If she was wrong, she would be wasting her time and the Covenant's resources on a wild goose chase. If she was right, and she was unable to eliminate or capture all hostiles in her first attack, she could very easily have caused the remaining members of the family to turn their efforts against the Covenant.
But there are, like, 8 of them, said Ryan.
His thoughts were confused, chasing each other around his head like puppies chasing their tails.
I don't know how many, since Vary was always pretty cagey about that, but I know they all live in the same house when they're at home. If there's one thing you should know about the Prices, it's that odds rarely work the way they should once the family decides to get involved.
Dominic smiled.
The Covenant had them outnumbered 10-1 in Buckley, and they survived. Margaret could easily have triggered a chain reaction no one was prepared for. Maybe she just did that anyway, said Uncle Mike. Verity dies? I can guarantee you that the Covenant of St. George isn't going to like what comes next.
Sir, while I respect the destructive power of your family more than you may believe, I can guarantee you in turn that if Verity dies, the Covenant will regret their actions long before any of her relations can get here. We get it, I said. If Verity dies, everybody's sorry. You know who's probably going to be sorriest? Verity. If this Margaret person wasn't allowed to be in North America, why is she here now?
I was told that it was a test for her, to see whether she could focus on the mission at the exclusion of her personal vendettas, said Dominic.
A sudden wave of regret, blame, and self-loathing rushed off him like it was trying to fill the entire room. It took everything I had to stay where I was. None of the others were telepathic, but they shouldn't have needed to be. He was practically screaming his pain.
Please forgive me. I believed them.
There was no reason for you not to, said Uncle Mike.
From his tone, I could tell he'd picked up on the same emotional weather I had. I relaxed a little.
Whatever lies the Covenant may have told you about the cryptids, they raised you. They trained you. Did they ever lie to you about anything but dogma before?
I don't know, said Dominic.
I hate the Covenant as much as anybody, but I'm willing to bet they didn't, because truth is the best way to guarantee obedience. The more lies you're told, the harder it gets to keep the story straight. When your bosses told you Margaret was here to test her obedience, you had absolutely no reason to think that they were lying to you. You got me? You warned Verity as soon as you had the chance. You did everything you could.
I didn't do enough.
Eustace yawned more widely than a strictly human jaw would have been able to support. There was an audible cracking noise as the bones shifted to accommodate the gesture. Dominic went very still, and I had the brief impression from his thoughts that he had managed, temporarily, to forget that humans were the minority in this room.
This is dull, Eustace announced. Are we going to stand here and debate blame while Verity is slaughtered? Vengeance carnage is often satisfying, but it takes longer to perform properly than that kind which does not require a death to begin. That's my girl, said Ryan. A delicate flower.
Eustace snorted. Dominic took a breath, seeming to center himself.
Margaret Healy hates Verity's bloodline for daring to leave the Covenant, he said, returning to his original conversational thread.
Smart boy.
She didn't accompany the investigative team because they thought her hatred might have dimmed.
They sent her here because somebody suspected you'd been compromised, didn't they?
Asked Uncle Mike. He sounded almost gentle. Dominic's obvious distress was getting to him. It was definitely getting to me. It was rolling off him in waves, making the air seem thick and heavy. Some emotions are harder to handle than others.
Yes. Dominic looked from me to Uncle Mike. I don't know how. I don't know what I did or didn't do or said or didn't say. I was so careful.
Kiddo, they've got charms and telepathy barriers on these people. They're loaded for metaphysical bear. For all we know, they've got a witch or something back at headquarters who did some remote viewing on you when you didn't even realize you were being watched. That would explain why they were able to drop Margaret at Sarah's hotel. But just because they got suspicious, that doesn't mean you did anything wrong. Beyond joining their goddamn cult in the first place.
I try not to eavesdrop on other people's minds most of the time. It makes me feel a little sleazy, like I'm living down to their expectations of my species. Still, that thought was loud enough that there was no way I could miss it. Uncle Mike, he didn't join, I said. He was born into the Covenant, the same way all of us were born into our lives. Please don't take that out on him. Not right now. Uncle Mike flinched a little, glancing in my direction. There was a brief flicker of apology in his emotional state. Then he focused back on Dominic and said,
"What matters now is that you're here with us, not there with them, and you're going to help us get her back. As far as I'm concerned, if you're on the up and up, we're cool, you and me."
A small throat was cleared from the center of the folding table, audible only because it was timed to come at the exact end of Uncle Mike's statement. I turned to see one of the Aeslin mice standing there, waiting to be noticed. It was the one Verity referred to as the head priest. He was wearing a sequin-spangled cape that used to be part of one of her dance costumes, and his whiskers were as white as if they'd been baby-powdered. They hadn't been. This was a very old mouse. Two other mice, younger, wearing unspangled capes, crouched a foot away from him. They must have been sent to assist him on what would be, to a mouse, a very dangerous journey.
"I come to speak the will of the colony," announced the mouse priest.
"Hello, mouse," said Eustace calmly, looking entirely unsurprised by the sudden intrusion of talking rodents on the conversation.
"Hello, carnivore," said the mouse priest.
He turned and bowed to Uncle Max and Dominic.
"Hail to the High Priest of Goddammit Eat Something Already, and to the God of Hard Choices in Dark Places."
Ryan blinked.
"What?"
"It's a mouse thing. Just roll with it. You'll be happier that way," I advised. "Hail," I added to the mouse. He sat up a little straighter, wrapping his pink thread of a tail around his feet, and adjusted his grip on the carved pencil he was using as a staff.
"The colony has discussed the disappearance of the Arboreal Princess," he said. "We have further discussed the words of the priestess before she was taken from us, and have decided that we will abide by her wisdom."
"What?" I asked. Uncle Mike blinked.
"Are you sure?"
he asked the mouse. The mouse priest nodded. The squirrel skull perched atop his head, making it look like he was going to topple over.
"We have served in this capacity before. We will serve in this capacity again. We are at your disposal."
"Before Verity left, she talked about using the mice as spies," said Ryan. "She even said that they were pretty good at it. Being mice means they can get into a lot of small spaces."
"We do not wish to leave our priestess in the grip of the false priestess who has taken her,"
said the Mouse Priest.
We understand that it will be dangerous. We do not mind the risk.
None of us do,
added Ryan.
Verity's not my family, but she's my friend. Whatever has to be done, I'm going to do it.
Dominic nodded. Then perhaps there is a chance after all.
But we need to move, and we need to move quickly. Then what are we waiting for?
Asked Uncle Mike.
Let's get started.
We all stopped interrupting Dominic after that. Even the mice were quiet, as we allowed him to get down to the business of properly explaining what he knew. According to Dominic, Margaret had been working on her own when she set the trap that eventually snared Verity. The anti-telepathy charm we took off her unconscious body was laced with a compulsion spell that forced Verity right back into her nasty little clutches. It was a neat trick. I might even have been impressed by it if it hadn't been so likely to get Verity killed. Dominic only knew that Verity had been taken because he'd been with one of the other Covenant agents, Peter Brandt, when Margaret called and asked for backup. Peter had gone without him, and Dominic had followed at what he guessed would be a safe distance.
Thanks to Verity and her maddening insistence on taking the rooftops whenever possible, I had a whole set of routes open to me that they barely realized existed. I was not seen.
Privately, I wasn't so sure, but I didn't interrupt. We were out of time for interruptions. There are times when I wonder how humans get anything done. Talking is so slow compared to the speed of thought. I could have told everyone everything Dominic knew in a few seconds, if I'd been attuned to them all and willing to risk bruising their brains a little bit. And then I realized that thinking like that just proves that I'll always be a cuckoo, no matter how hard I try not to be, and I have to force myself back into the slow, comforting safety of speech.
"Where's Verity being held?"
asked Uncle Mike.
"An old warehouse that the Covenant purchased during the last purge. Much like this locale," Dominic indicated the nest. "It has been in private hands for so long that most have ceased viewing it as a building. It has become a part of the landscape."
"Well, then, I guess we're landscapers," said Uncle Mike. "We're going to need some muscle for this."
Slowly, Ryan smiled.
"I think I can help you with that."
Eustace looked up at him, her thoughts turning quizzical. Then she smiled as well.
"Oh, lovely," she said.
"I do so enjoy spending time with my co-workers in a social setting."
Ryan was on the phone with Kitty, explaining why he needed to borrow half her staff for a potentially deadly mission, when my own phone started ringing. Phones are tricky. They have no minds for me to read, which makes them a good exercise in telling what people mean from nothing but tone. That also makes them frustrating as hell, and a bad idea when I'm already stressed. I pulled it out of my pocket, checking the display to see who was calling. I was about to press ignore when Uncle Mike's hand landed on my shoulder.
"Take it,"
he advised.
"You need to talk to him, and it's not like you're going anywhere dangerous."
"Right," I said, not sure whether I should be annoyed with him for meddling or grateful for the excuse. I pressed answer instead, bringing the phone to my ear as I started walking away from the others. If I was going to have this conversation, I was going to have it in my room.
"Hi, Artie. What's up?"
"I hadn't heard from you in a few hours, and you're not online. You've got the Covenant in town. Verity's not answering her phone. I got worried. Hey, presto, I'm calling you."
Artie's voice was a warm, familiar presence in my ear, conjuring images of afternoons spent lying on his bedroom floor, arguing about whether Wolverine's claws could pierce Captain America's shield. They so could, assuming Wolverine cared enough to try. And the fact that I know that is why Artie and I get along so well, and why Verity despairs of me ever going on a real date with a non-virtual boy. Those comforting thoughts were followed by a chill sliding down my spine, chasing all the warmth away. Artie didn't know that Verity was missing. Uncle Mike knew, but apart from that, no one in the family had been notified.
"It's good to hear your voice," I said, with utter sincerity,
and closed my eyes as I walked up the stairs. Maybe if I looked at nothing, I wouldn't feel so bad about lying by omission.